specific. So small animals like harbor porpoise that have very high metabolic rates. So they're spending about 95% of their life foraging. Whereas we've shown with southern resident killer whales, in the absence of vessels, they spend about 70 to 84% of their time foraging. So these animals have massive appetites, so they have to spend a lot of their day searching for that food. So there's still a lot that we don't understand about how they're able to do that and find fish in the ocean. But there's certain parts of the Salish Sea that we know are good hunting grounds. So for example, similar to running buffalo off a cliff, for example, if you're imagining that you're swimming in a 3D environment and you're trying to catch a salmon, it can escape in any direction. It's not constrained to walk on land like our prey might be. And so finding an underwater cliff that you can drive the salmon at, and particularly the surface as well, there are particular places that make it easier to catch salmon or chinook. And so noise in those parts of their foraging habitat can be more, is likely to be more impactful than in other places. So finding sort of places where there's no boat zones or interim sanctuary zones or places where there's good hunting and reducing the impacts of underwater noise would be one of the target outcomes of some of this. And that's the reason why the commercial vessel slowdowns has been targeting Harrow Strait, because the west side of San Juan Island is a hotspot for foraging, as well as Boundary Pass off of Saturna Island. It has historically been an important foraging area.
So commercial ships seem like they're both easier to study and easier to get participation in actions. But has much research been done on the impact of pleasure craft and small vessels?
Yeah, so we're starting to look at that. We've been working with the Saturna Island Marine Research and Education Society, or SIMRES, and we've been working on East Point, which is part of the Southern Gulf Islands National Park System. And we've been looking at the presence and the numbers of fishing vessels, as well as pleasure craft that are using Boundary Pass. And part of Boundary Pass is a temporary no boat go zone for the summer when the salmon are running, and when typically the southern resident killer whales are using that location for foraging. And this summer, there's been COVID going on the last couple summers for the most part, which means that US boats, pleasure craft, for example, haven't been allowed to come across the international boundary between the US and Canada. And so when the boundary opened, or when the border opened, which I think was around August 7th or August 9th, the numbers of commercial, or sorry, recreational boats went from about 200 up to about 340 boats a day in Boundary Pass. So that gives you kind of an idea of how many boats go through Boundary Pass that are either bombing through or else going through slowly fishing.
So with the southern resident whales, facing a lot of challenges, it seems like fairly important research. What does the future of research look like, and what is it you still need to try and discover and understand about these whales and their feeding habits?
So what I alluded to earlier was about this forecast system. And so in order to be able to work in real time, we've been developing this forecast system, which takes information from citizen scientists who are on the water all the time observing whales or finding whales. As well, we've been developing underwater hydrophone information processing through models that use artificial intelligence. So we've got some deep learning innovations that we're working on. And those are to be able to listen 24 hours a day and automatically detect when a killer whale is heard on the hydrophone. And so this will give us a warning for the commercial vessels coming in that there are whales that are overlapping the shipping lanes. So that would
and
give
you,
them
you
a...
You would identify them essentially by their voice?
Yeah, exactly. So speak, I was talking earlier about, call types of different pods. So the using this, we'll be able to tell where J pod is moving, where K pod, L pod are moving within the Salish Sea, and give a projection. And right now we've using only visual data. We're estimating movement times about 2.5 hours ahead. So that's time enough. That's about 80 nautical miles in terms of how fast a ship is moving. On average, obviously. And then, so that gives them time to slow a vessel down.
Great. Well, it seems like important research, given what we know about the struggles the southern resident population is having. So thank you and your colleagues for looking into this. And particularly the increase in underwater data you're able to collect about their location and movement seems really important. Is there anything particular you're planning in the next year or two in terms of your research?
Well, we've been focusing a lot on southern resident killer whales because of their endangered status. And there's been a lot of changes recently in the way that they're using the habitat in the southern in the Salish Sea. As well, there's a bunch of other interesting whales that are using the same waters. So we're hoping to extend the machine learning algorithms, the artificial intelligence neural nets, to start thinking about other whales that could benefit from some of these shipping changes in routing and speed. So we're expanding beyond southern resident killer whales and that's our focus in the next few years.
Great. Well, thank you for speaking to me today. I hope your research continues to have an impact on helping the situation for these whales and all the other species that we don't really see under the water, but I'm sure are very much impacted by the same kind of issues.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your interest in this topic, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Dr. Ruth Joy of SFU.
Thank you to Dr. Ruth Joy of SFU's Department of Environmental Science and also the Department of Statistics for speaking to us about this very fascinating project. As you know, killer whales are under a lot of stress in our region, and the more we know about it, the better. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Bird songs come in many shapes and sizes. When a sage thrasher, perched atop a clump of sagebrush, tips its head back to sing, the notes rush forth. What you just heard is a mere snippet. Sage thrashers often sing nonstop for at least 2 minutes and can go on for more than 20. In stark comparison, a brewer's blackbird singing to the world from atop a fence post sounds brusque. One full song from a brewer's blackbird lasts barely a second. Amazingly, a Henslow's sparrow values brevity even more. That was it. In case you missed it, here it is again. But whether long, drawn out, or short and sweet, bird songs are all about the same things, territory and breeding. claiming a space and attracting a mate. Once those are sorted out, further singing by the male is all about keeping his territory intact. As for the sage thrasher, he's still going strong. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Our listeners continue to send us questions about Lyme testing. Specifically, how is blood tested in Canada? And even more importantly, is it a reliable way to diagnose Lyme? Let's go back to the microscope for a lesson in serology. Victoria Sanderson is a researcher at the G. Magnotta Lab at the University of Guelph. She just published some groundbreaking research. Let's learn from another incredible Canadian scientist. Welcome to our podcast, Victoria.
Thank you so much for having me today, Sarah.
How did you become interested in Lyme disease research?
I've always wanted to get into a healthcare-related field. But nearing the end of my undergraduate degree, I started hearing about this new lab that had started up in Guelph that studied Lyme disease, which has a personal connection for me. And as I started doing more reading and learning about the science and the clinical aspects of Lyme disease, the more intrigued I became by the complexities of the microbiology and the pathology of Lyme disease. And this opportunity to combine my interest in clinical research and the ability to use my biology background for such an important cause really drew me in.
And can you tell us just a little bit about your personal connection to Lyme?
Sure. Yeah. So my mom was diagnosed with Lyme kind of around the same time at the end of my undergraduate degree. And so I saw, firsthand how much it can affect somebody and their family. And I think that's really motivated me in this work as well. And I see it affecting so many other people. And it really is a great cause and really interesting from the science perspective as well. So it's a great balance between the two.
Absolutely. And it's a relief to see your loved ones getting better. So that part's super important and very motivating. We have spoken to a few people at the G. Magnotta Lab in previous podcasts. We spoke to Rossana Magnotta, and we also spoke to Dr. Melanie Wills, so people can go and learn from them as well. But let's focus on your research, which was on around the testing. So what is whole blood, plasma, and serum?
So this is the work that I've been working on, but it really is a team effort at the Magnotta Lab and all the people you mentioned, as well as so many others in the lab. It's such a team effort, and they've contributed to this work as well. So I just wanted to acknowledge all of them because it's a really great environment to be a part of. My work with the diagnostic testing in blood, we looked at different things. So the whole blood, plasma, and serum, they're different components of the blood. And whole blood is kind of what you would typically imagine with the red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, and lots of other things. And then plasma and serum are the liquid portions once all the cells have been removed. And the difference between these, the plasma and serum, is that plasma has clotting factors in it, while the serum doesn't have the clotting factors left. And this difference is a result of how they're collected. So serum is typically collected by allowing whole blood to form a clot once it's removed from the body. And then collecting that liquid portion. So the clotting factors are left in the clot and the liquid portion doesn't have those. Well, plasma is, there's many ways to collect it, but one way is via centrifugation and separating the blood cells out of the liquid. But this leaves the clotting factors in that liquid fraction.
And which part of the blood were you looking at specifically?
Yeah, we looked at a variety of different fractions. So we used this technique I mentioned, centrifugation, to separate different components. So we had plasma, we had serum, we had whole blood, and then we also separated out different blood cells. So we had a red blood cell enriched fraction. We had a platelet enriched fraction, and we were able to look at those different components of blood in a mock infection environment with Borrelia in there to see where the Borrelia tended to spend its time.
I know you spent a lot of time looking through a microscope. What were you looking for and how did you quantify it?
I did spend a lot of hours looking through a microscope, and so does the rest of the lab, just looking at little squiggly lines that wiggle around. And we use it for a lot of different purposes in the lab, but one big one is to quantify Borrelia. Unlike other species of bacteria, we can't use typical methods of quantifying a lab culture, such as turbidity or a plating technique, because they haven't been optimized or aren't possible with Borrelia. So instead, we have to use these little squared chips and put a little drop of the culture in there, and we look inside a little square and count how many little squiggly lines we see, and we can extrapolate that up to per milliliter values. And that gives us an idea of how much a culture is growing or how much is in there at a given time. And yeah, sometimes we'd have to count thousands of those at one sitting. So it's fun for sure.
It must have been in your dreams.
It absolutely was. We joke about that.
Now, which findings did you find most interesting from that?
Yeah, we learned some really interesting things. So looking at those different fractions that I mentioned when we were looking at liquid things like plasma and serum versus cell fractions, and comparing how much Borrelia was in each of those fractions after a mock infection in whole blood and separating that out. So we found that the platelet fraction that we separated out was enriched with Borrelia after that mock infection. So we were able to see it better under the microscope. We were able to detect it, the proteins that it produces, better using a Western blot technique. And we were also able to detect it better in that fraction using PCR, which detects DNA. So we used multiple techniques there and compared it to those other fractions.
And then
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so compared to what they are using for testing, are they looking at the platelet fraction in the current testing they're using in Canada?
Yeah, so that's a bit of a complicated question.
Okay.
Because the current testing is indirect, so it's looking for antibodies.
Right.
So they're not looking necessarily for the bacteria itself. But in research, we might want to be able to detect the bacteria itself. And eventually, if a diagnostic test came out of that, that could be very interesting. But in the research world, it's really great to, yeah, be able to detect that bacteria and see what it's doing. So that's been a really big challenge in research, is to find where that bacteria is in human samples. So we were trying to see if there was a way to optimize how we process blood to detect the bacteria. So one way is by looking in these different fractions potentially. And yeah, we found that the platelet fraction might be a good opportunity to find these bacteria.
That's so interesting. So just to make sure I've got this right for our listeners, the current testing is using indirect testing in Canada, and the tests you're doing is direct testing, where you're actually looking at the Borrelia spirochete and you're counting those under the microscope, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can do those direct tests in a variety of ways, and microscopy is one, or we can try and detect the proteins or the DNA eventually would be great as well, yeah.
Wow. Okay, now let's go over, I know you also did research on the anticoagulants that are used to store the blood samples. Can you tell us more about that part of your research?
Yeah, that's also an interesting finding. It was part of that whole project and in the same paper that I'm sure we'll link here for the listeners. So with the anticoagulants, there are three main types of vacutainers, we call them. So when you get your blood taken into a little container, it's called a vacutainer. And sometimes they're coated with an anticoagulant, which stops that clotting process that I was talking about earlier. And sometimes they're uncoated because we want it to clot and maybe we're collecting the serum. So we considered a few different anticoagulants, EDTA and citrate. So these work in similar ways, but they have slight differences. So we wanted to consider how they might be affecting the bacteria. So currently in the clinical culture literature, we kind of reviewed the papers out there currently and found that 39% of clinical culture studies use EDTA, 11% use citrate, and 18% use heparin, which has been previously shown to be less useful in Borrelia detection here, and then 32% use uncoated. So essentially, there was no consensus approach to Borrelia recovery, so we wanted to figure out, hey, is there an optimized option that we could be using here? So I wanted to see how citrate and EDTA impacted Borrelia growth itself. So I inoculated liquid Borrelia culture into the Vacutainer tube with the two anticoagulants compared to the uncoated control. So after incubation with the anticoagulant, the cultures were grown up for 2 weeks, and what we found was that EDTA significantly impeded the bacteria's ability to grow compared to a control culture. On the other hand, citrate was within range of the uncoated control, and therefore the better option for direct Borrelia recovery, despite only being used in 11% of previous research. So this doesn't directly impact that serological indirect test that's currently being used. However, it's really exciting for research purposes so that we can optimize how this direct detection research is being conducted.
Absolutely. And so that is my next question. Where do you want to focus your research next? Where do you think these findings are going to take you next?
Yeah, there's so many exciting questions and lines of research in Lyme disease. And yeah, all of this work so far has been conducted in mock-infected samples, so using laboratory strains of Borrelia that we inoculate into clean blood samples, I guess you might say. So a clear next step for me is to look at naturally infected patient blood samples and ask questions about recovery and direct detection of the bacteria in those samples. So we have lots of exciting projects on the go in our lab at the moment, so I'm excited to see those results and continue contributing to the Lyme disease literature.
So maybe even for our other scientists that are out there listening, can you tell us a little bit about the difference between that mock infection that you're doing versus naturally infected blood? How did you do a mock infection?
Yeah, so the mock infections, what happens is we collect blood just from healthy participants that volunteer into those Vacutainers. And then we take our Borrelia culture that we grow up in the lab. So that's typically a strain called B31, which is just a laboratory strain of Borrelia. And we grow up these cultures in the lab in a liquid culture, and we're able to take some of that and inoculate it into the healthy blood Vacutainers. And we're able to control how kind of the concentration of the bacteria in there. So it's a really nice way to standardize that for research purposes. So it's a really great starting place because we were able to see kind of what proportion separated out where and the growth rates, and really keep things very consistent, which is so important when you're asking these research questions. And then the naturally infected blood samples would be from Lyme disease patients themselves. So they're harder to control because you don't know exactly how much Borrelia is in a given sample, but it would be more applicable and translational to clinical presentations of Lyme disease.
So what could success look like in the future when we do have better diagnostic testing?
Yeah, so I guess the ingredients of an ideal diagnostic test are that it would be sensitive, which would help us avoid false negatives. It would be specific to help us avoid false positives, and it would be incredibly helpful to have an indication of active infection and the disease stage. Is this an acute infection? Is this post-treatment? Is this chronic? And this would allow us to monitor disease progression as well as response to treatment. A test that checked all of these boxes would allow us to monitor the state of infection, the progression, correlation to disease presentation. And the first step to so much of Lyme disease research in terms of things like treatment is to ensure we fully understand the underlying state of infection and the microbiology behind it, and then we can progress to treatment efficacy and so many other opportunities as well.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, we did a great interview with Dr. Armin Schwarzbach, and he did speak about sensitivity and specificity as well. So if people want to dive deeper into that, they can go back and listen to that episode. I want to congratulate you, Victoria. I know you're going into your second year of medical school. Way to go. And my question is, how do you think your research will give you a broader, enhanced perspective in your medical practice?
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. I'm super excited to get back into classes soon after a summer of research and some work and relaxation as well. So I think having a background in research and learning those critical analysis skills and developing research questions will allow me to think really deeply about what I'm learning and how the research impacts patients directly. And I hope to keep research as part of my future in medicine as well in some way. It's very rewarding and exciting to be the first person to find an answer to a certain question. And there's just so much to still be discovered out there as well. And I'm also just very inspired by the LEMS community. Everyone is so incredibly resilient and passionate. And I think seeing individuals and groups of people fight so hard against their illness and to ensure they're properly cared for really inspires me in an advocacy role. And seeing all of this firsthand, I think will help me in my future practice to be a really caring listener and to really look at the overall picture of a patient's state of health while also ensuring every patient feels heard and cared for as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much for your time and your expertise, Victoria.
Thank you, Sarah. It's been really nice talking with you.
That was Victoria Sanderson, a researcher at the G. Magnotta Lab in Guelph. I found it really interesting to learn more about direct testing and how the Borrelia spirochete is being found in the platelet fraction of the blood. I'm your host, Sarah Cormode. That's another episode of Looking at Lyme. Remember, stay safe in the outdoors.
Thank you for listening today. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Speak Up comes to you every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday with a special edition on Friday with Sister C. Charlotte Farrell. Coming up in just a few minutes is Democracy Now! We bring that to you every Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. And later on at noon is Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy coming up at 2 p.m. Generic Alternative, and at 3 p.m. typically Tuesday. Stay tuned and keep on listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.